We'll go ahead and get started. I'm Glenn Lambert. I have the privilege of chairing this session and introducing our speaker. I did try to do a great deal of research on him, but I'm very sad and disappointed to announce that there was nothing in the National Enquirer or Parade magazine that indicated. So if you look at more scholarly things, you may find things about him. The rules, I'd like to remind all of you to please turn off your cell phones or your texts or whatever that you have that makes you feel extraordinarily important. You can turn them on and be important after the session in an hour. Also, so we'd appreciate that. Also, after his speech, his paper, we will be taking questions. If you'll come up to the microphone, that would be helpful. Also state your name so that we can get you in the National Enquirer. And so it's my privilege to announce or introduce Richard Dulewski.
I hope I said that. Dulewski?
Dulewski. Dulewski. He works as a licensed clinical social worker in emergency departments at various inpatient psychiatric units and emergency rooms to evaluate mental health needs of clients. He's also been working as a military contractor to provide services for all branches of the armed forces around the world. He was born overseas, and at 19 he joined the church. Both history and church history has really been an avocation, and he likes that. He has extensive experience in teaching, supervising, in lots of different settings, and has worked throughout the United States and is Europe. He's the father of three adult children and has been married to Kathy. Is Kathy here?
No.
Okay. And we appreciate, look forward to his paper. And right before, would you be so kind as to close? I think the air conditioning's working better in here than in the other room, so it'll keep it a bit quieter. So, thank you. So, Richard, we turn the time over to you.
Thank you, Glenn. I'm glad you didn't find anything in the National Enquirer. My undergrad is English, and I'm not sure how much I have good to say about that. I prefer at this point to read from a text, though I usually am spontaneous, mostly because the information is so detailed. I'm lucky that I'm nearsighted, so I don't have to see your individual faces in order to read my text. I'm also heartened by your appearance here today. I find myself both excited and nervous. I'm excited about the subject and the material I have, but I'm nervous about the ability to present it in a concise and clear manner that will increase your understanding. I hope that you can walk away today with a better understanding of the personality and the disposition of Emma. I'd like to thank Sunstone Magazine for sponsoring the symposium and allowing me to present my thoughts on Emma Hale Smith. I would also like to dedicate these remarks to Valene Tibbetts-Avery and Linda King Newell, who authored what I consider to be the seminal text on Emma Smith. I take no credit for finding or discovering any of the stories or information that I share with you today. I have merely gathered them from sources to help illustrate a picture of Emma's character and personality. To the writers, researchers, and family societies, I would like to give thanks and acknowledgement for all they have accomplished, which is no small amount, I might add. My purpose today is simply to present historical information, since that has been done in other publications and settings. It's not simply to present historical information, since that's been done in other settings by those better qualified than I. My purpose is to look at the events in Emma's life with experience as a therapist. Since I've been looking at these events from this perspective, I should tell you a little bit about what I do. I'm a trained, licensed, and clinical social worker, as Glenn said. My work experience includes 25 years in mental health, 13 of them as a social worker. I currently work conducting evaluations in a hospital emergency room, but I've also worked as a contractor, or at least a contractor gives me work to do overseas, working with families and military bases around the world. In that setting, I help families to adjust to problems related to deployment and family changes that occur as a result of that. Over the years, I've worked with individuals, couples, families, and children. I have worked with them in a crisis as well as helping them cope with day-to-day problems. With this as a backdrop, let's look at some of the events in Emma's life. When people ask what caused a change in Emma's behavior, what they really are asking is, why didn't she go west with the Saints? And when people say that she was wrong for remaining in Nauvoo, they are implying that they know what she should have done. In fact, many come to these conclusions without knowing many details about Emma's life. Some people might say that something about her changed, and that is why she did not come to Salt Lake Valley. I would suggest that she didn't change. And in order to understand this, we need to look at her personality and what she experienced prior to the death of Joseph. There are many resources now available from which we draw information about events, personality, and disposition of Emma. What shaped her personality? What experienced her, influenced her behavior? Before we try to answer these questions, let's review some of the important elements of human behavior that can be applied to our understanding of her decisions. First, human emotions are predictable, but the behavioral responses are not. Second, people make decisions based on their own life experience. We do not all come to the same conclusion because we have the same experience. You can have two people who have the same experience yet respond in different ways. I'm really exposed to this day to day in the emergency room, and I'm just really stunned at the same presentation that results in different responses. Third, it's difficult to know exactly how we will respond to an event or an experience until we actually have it. We would like to think we know how we will respond, but we will not really know until we have had that experience. Fourth, how people respond and judge others tells us as much about them as it does about the person being observed. And finally, we are always having a difficult time understanding someone's behavior if we do not gather sufficient information. One small piece of information can change a perspective entirely. And that is why we sometimes hear the remark, "Oh, that is why they did that." Or even the more familiar, "If I had known that, I would have done it differently." And so this brings us to the point of this lecture today. To help us all understand why Emma made the decision to remain in Nauvoo after the martyrdom of Joseph the prophet. Perhaps if we view her life from her eyes, we can have a better understanding about her decisions. I might add here that I will not be viewing her decisions and behaviors in the framework of any Freudian or Jungian philosophy or even any kind of complicated psychological profile. Instead, I would like to consider her decisions from a more pragmatic view, from basic elements and patterns of behavior that I have observed over the years. I might add that some of these will be very familiar to you, so I'm not going to be presenting anything that's profound or new. Since we do not have time to recount detailed event of her entire life, I'd like to examine certain aspects and see what information we can draw from them. The areas that I've decided to look at more closely are her childhood experience, her experience in bearing children, the moves and locations where she lived, and the overarching influence of the practice of plural marriage. Emma was born in 1804 and was the seventh of nine children. Her father was a relatively successful man and was known by his neighbors for his generosity. Her parents made it their task to educate the children, and Emma appears to have been the most promising of the children and received an additional year of education, a noteworthy accomplishment in her day. In fact, she also had the experience of being a schoolteacher prior to meeting Joseph. This means that she gained experience preparing lessons and teaching children. Her mother also ran a boarding home in order to supplement the family income. This included greeting and accommodating guests, as well as cooking and caring for their needs. It is this experience that probably was the basis of her reputation as an accomplished cook and host. Some of her traits were known early in her childhood. When she was young, she learned to canoe on the Susquehanna River. This is also where she learned how to ride horses. Throughout her life, she was considered to be a good horse, to have good horsemanship, both in driving carriages and riding horseback. Those of you who know anything about horses know that you cannot be tibben in order to manage a horse well. That is why in the film Emma Smith, My Story, she is seen out riding Joseph. This, by the way, is a film put out by the Joseph Smith and Emma Hale Smith Society in conjunction with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who also funded some of that. On another occasion, when they were living in Pennsylvania, we know that she mounted a horseback and rode quickly to notify Joseph that people were coming to try and find the plates. There's an image for you. A dark-haired 20-year-old woman racing down a country road, her hair probably flying in the wind, in order to notify her husband of an impending emergency. Her quick wit and pleasant personality endeared her to her neighbors and friends. Once she reached full maturity, she stood 5 feet 9 inches tall and was, quote, of excellent form, straight and above medium height, features strongly marked, hair and eyes brown, while her general intelligence and fearless integrity united her with kindness of heart and splendid physical developments commanded both admiration and respect, unquote. Knowledge of her behaviors and the events in her life show that the latter descriptions of her personality be very accurate, that is, the integrity and her general presentation. She was well known for intelligence and discretion and commanding figure. Joseph did not marry a wilting violet. One of her adult female friends, Emmeline B. Wells, noted that Sister Emma was benevolent and hospitable. She drew around her a large circle of friends who were like good comrades. She was motherly in nature to young people, always had a houseful to entertain or be entertained. She was very high-spirited, and the brother and sisters paid her great respect. Emma was a great solace to her husband in all his persecutions and the severe ordeals through which he passed. She was always ready to encourage and comfort him, devoted to his interests, and was constantly by him whenever it was possible. She was a queen in her home, so to speak, and beloved by the people who were, many of them, indebted to her for favors and kindness. Lucy Maxsmith describes her in this manner. I have never seen a woman in my life who would endure every species of fatigue and hardship from month to month and from year to year with that unflinching courage, zeal, and patience which she has ever done. For I know that which she has had to endure. She has been tossed upon the ocean of uncertainty. She has breasted the storms of persecution and buffeted the rage of men and devils, which would have borne down almost any other woman. This description comes from a woman who herself had seen her own share of difficulties and strife. An observation by a man who lived in Nauvoo as a child provides this account. I saw Mrs. Smith at least once a day most of the time. The young people of the community were in the habit of gathering in the evening at Emma's home. I can still taste Mrs. Smith's cookies after all these years. Everyone in town liked them. To attest to the quality of these cookies, it is also worth relating the following account. One day, several boys scuffled along the riverbank, and one fell in. His friends fished him out, then took him to Emma, who removed his wet clothing, dressed him in some old clothes, then gave them all cookies. From that time on, falling in the river became a frequent occurrence. Perhaps my favorite account of Emma Smith is provided by a more objective source. A noted journalist from New York City, Julius Chambers, happened on Nauvoo and provided this vivid description. And I would like to read this in his own words. In the summer of 1872, I was paddling down the Mississippi in a canoe. At the nightfall of a July evening, after a long day's work, I saw on the Illinois shore, upon a fine bluff, a red brick building that indicated a town of more than village size. Making a landing, I climbed to the top of the plateau and learned that the building that had attracted my attention was the only hotel in the place. When I applied at the office for supper, I was received by an elderly woman. My eye memory of the face and the figure of the distinguished old lady is quite distinct. She was tall for her sex, Her hair was gray, not white, and was combed straight over her temples. This lady was a widow of Joseph Smith. The dear old woman put me to shame with her dignified forbearance when I asked if she had ever seen those plates or the miraculous pair of spectacles known in Mormon history as Urim and Thummim. She had not, but they veritably existed. Had I seen the tablets of stone that Moses received? Did I doubt the miracles of the Savior? Faith was comprised in the acceptance of things not seen, she said to me. We talked long into the evening, for this aged woman appeared glad to see even a boy from the Great East. She asked me 1,000 questions, many of which I could not answer. She was a picture of a fine woman, stranded on the ice shore of age, amid surroundings with which she was entirely out of sympathy, and among people who did not appreciate her intellect or her innate refinement. I believe she had a husband about the place, but the pride of living she felt was not as his spouse. What earthly honor and renown she claimed was solely as, quote, the widow of Joseph Smith, a sincere believer, devout man, and a living husband, unquote. Thus did she speak of the dead prophet to me. To me, the description of having innate refinement is very telling and goes further than any single adjective or set of adjectives in providing a picture of her personality and demeanor. Having family and friends visit was a joy in her life, but she was not a gossip. On one occasion, while writing her son, she said that she did not have any news. She attributed this to the fact that, quote, the tattlers have all got tired of telling me anything, unquote, because they needed someone to put their stories, quote, into circulation, and, unquote, and she did not do that. There are many accounts from her life where she would be relied on to be discreet. From her youth, she had the reputation of being able to hold her tongue when it was necessary. These are accounts of a woman who clearly impressed those whom she encountered. They are and should be the basic elements through which we should consider the decisions, her decisions. The account of Emma's presence and personality were recorded in a number of journals in Nauvoo. She was portrayed as a woman of commanding presence and seemed rarely to lose control or turn to tears. She was described as a brilliant conversationalist and high-spirited. On one occasion, a man teased her about fishing for compliments. She quickly replied, "I never fish in shallow water." As to the negative reports about Emma, I would respond with the following. Emma had the habit of reading her audience in order to measure her response. Linda and Valine allude to this in their book when they wrote, quote, "Visitors to Emma's home in Nauvoo sent increasingly negative descriptions back to Utah. How Emma responded to them depended on the attitude they brought with them. If they were open and warm, she talked freely with them. If they came to challenge her, to prove points of doctrine, or to criticize, she withdrew." Here we see that those who took negative comments back to the Great Basin tended to see what they wanted to see. There were few accounts that I ever read where she made negative or harmful comments about others. When people came to see Emma, they usually took away the same impression with which they came. Emma responded to kindness and respect in kind. Anyone who brought anger, bitterness, or negative judgments were usually met with silence. I'd like to provide a brief account of the places she lived and the homes which she lived. Now, I've constructed here a kind of flow sheet that pertains to the towns where she resided and the homes where she lived prior to the death of Joseph. I apologize for the crudeness, but I did want to provide you a visual. Even though on the back you may not see the names, each of those black squares or circles represents a location where they lived. And the ones in red, if you can see them, 400, 500, represent places where she actually, was their home. And the two on the top was the same building. Emma had a brother named Jesse, and he had a cabin near her mom's place. And when Jesse moved to Ohio, they allowed her to stay there. So that was the first home that they really had. I'm hoping that we finish in time to answer questions, because I know that some of the remarks going to make might raise other thoughts, and I'm glad to answer those. But in the interest of time, let me just go through quickly read what I prepared. She moved from Pennsylvania to New York to Ohio to Missouri and then Illinois. She moved 18 times and lived in 13 different houses, occasionally returning to houses a second time. Of these 13 locations, only four of them could be called their own. Though they lived in Kirtland the longest, 7 years, they only had a cabin of their own for a short time. On three of these moves, she had to leave behind most or all of her furniture. On four occasions, she moved due to disruption caused by neighbors. On two additional occasions, she was driven from her home at the threat of her life. All of this in the course of the 17 years she was married to Joseph. After his death, she moved away from Nauvoo briefly for about 6 months. Then she returned to live in a home she owned there. As a therapist based on these merits alone, I would have to say, why would anyone even ask why she remained in Nauvoo? This city was the only location where she had access to any economic resources. In Joseph's account, he owed approximately $70,000 at the time of his death. That would be well over $500,000 in today's currency. Emma had long been handling the finances for the family due to the frequent absences of Joseph. She had a clear understanding of her precarious financial situation. I might add that the things that made her a great wife for Joseph to support and carry on while he was gone required a kind of forthrightness and outspokenness that did make men in those days a little bit uncomfortable. In discussing the children she bore, we should remember that in her day, the middle of the 19th century, it was common to lose more than one child in the birthing process for the childhood disease. She actually bore 9 children and only raised 5 of them to adulthood. One of those died at the age of 26. When her own set of twins, born in 1830, died, she adopted 2 from the Murdoch family, whose mother had died during childbirth. Later, one of the Murdoch twins died due to exposure at 23 months of age because of mob violence. Emma's father and mother died in 1839 and 1842, respectively. She had not seen them since the time they left Nauvoo from Ohio, from the time they left Ohio in 1831. She was only 26 at the time she left Pennsylvania. Her father never really reconciled her marriage to Joseph. This means that by the time she was 40 years old, her husband had been murdered by a mob. Both her father and father-in-law had died. Her mother had died. 3 of her brother-in-laws had died, one by violence. And 5 of her children had died, one of them by violence. If someone with Emma's experience came to me, I would talk about these deaths and see what effect sorrow had had upon her. Some people become paralyzed by sorrow. Emma did not. Dealing with tragedy can be difficult. Under these conditions, one could reasonably conclude that she did not travel west in order to avoid avoid losing any more of her children. Lucy Mack Smith did not move west. Few negative things have been said about that. Given these losses, it appears to me that Emma managed quite well. In later years, one of Emma's children, Emma Bell Smith Kennedy, did make the following observation. Referring to Emma, she said, quote, "Her eyes were brown and sad. She would smile with her lips, but to me, as small as I was, I never saw the brown eyes smile. I asked my mother one day, 'Why don't Grandma laugh with her eyes like you do?' And my mother said, 'Because she has a deep sorrow in her heart.'" And how can we really blame her? She had experienced very much sorrow. We probably need to acknowledge that she was an excellent mother and managed her life quite well despite all of these losses. You cannot separate the sorrow from her decision to remain in Nauvoo. We humans rarely make decisions in isolation from our life experience. Plural marriage. Well, this brings me to the part of Emma's life that I would like to look at. What can we say about plural marriage? Where to start? This is not the place to provide or analyze the history of plural marriage. There are good resources that have done that. But we can look at here at the effect it had on Emma and Joseph's marriage. It appears that Joseph first began to inquire about prior marriage after translating the Bible in 1831. As was the pattern for Joseph, when he inquired in prayer, he would receive an answer. And there were times when the answer would fall outside conventional beliefs, and it appears that plural marriage was one of them. There is evidence that Joseph married a woman while in Kirtland. He had also broached the subject with Emma in Kirtland and discovered that she was not supportive of this practice. My wife shares that, I believe, by the way. There also appears to have been opposition by others within the church while in Kirtland, and so Joseph did not do any more with the principle until the church arrived in Nauvoo. In fact, Joseph himself seems to have been in conflict with the principle. He says that he had communication with angels, and he related the following to Mary Rollins Littner. The angel came to me three times between the year of 1834 and 1842 and said I was to obey that principle or he would slay me. He states that on the last occasion, the angel appeared with a drawn sword. In Joseph's mind, the failure to practice plural marriage threatened both his temporal life and his eternal salvation. Given this personal tension, he appears to have proceeded with great caution. Now permit me to read directly from the text of Mormon Enigma. On the evening of April 5th, 1841, Joseph Bates Nobel crossed the river from Montrose, Iowa, and met Joseph Smith under an elm tree. 26-year-old Louisa Beeman, dressed in a man's hat and coat, stood at Joseph's side. With Joseph telling him the words of the ceremony, Nobel married his wife's sister to the Mormon prophet. The previous fall, Joseph had approached Nobel, a close friend, confiding in him the principles of celestial marriage. He said that God had revealed the doctrine to him in Kirtland, but that an angel of the Lord had now appeared to him, commanding that he introduce this new order of marriage. Joseph swore Nobel to secrecy, saying, I have placed my life in your hands. Therefore, do not in an evil hour betray me to my enemies. Closer readings and research, you will find that the main reason for his oppositions in 1843 and 44 were based to a large part to the practice of plural marriage, that those members who had left the church found their greatest conflict in that principle. From this point on, Joseph married 11 other women in the course of the next 15 months, from April 1841 to July 1842. He tried to introduce this teaching at a Sunday morning sermon given in the summer of 1841. However, this was met with much opposition, and in a sermon later that same afternoon, he minimized his message, telling the saints that, quote, the time for plural wives was in the future, and admonished his listeners not to be concerned. Despite these words, records indicate that Joseph continued the practice. He married 11 women in 1842 and 17 in 1843. The historians disagree on the exact number, and they range from 26 to as high as 84. But for the purpose of this presentation, it's not the number that concerns us. It's the effect that this practice had on the relationship between Emma and Joseph. Emma was not told of Joseph's marriages directly. She pieced information together. For 3 years, between 1841 and 1843, the practice of plural marriage took its toll on their marriage. Emma seemed at times to wax and wane in her acceptance of the practice. By the summer of 1843, she appears to have come to some resolution in her own mind. She agreed to allow the practice if she could choose the women. In May of 1843, she presented two women to Joseph, giving permission for him to marry them. She chose Emily and Eliza Partridge. On May 23, 1843, she watched as Judge James Adams married Joseph to Emily and Eliza. However, what she did not know, and what Joseph did not tell her, was that these two women had been married to him 2 months earlier. The events surrounding plural marriage and its effect on the relationship appears to have culminated in July of 1843. At this time, Hiram and Joseph were talking about plural marriage. William Clayton, a historian recorder for Joseph, relates the following account. Hiram said, if you will write this revelation on celestial marriage, I will take and read it to Emma, and I believe I can convince her of its truth, and you will hereafter have peace. Joseph's response was, "You do not know Emma as well as I do." Hiram continued, stating that he could convince any, quote, reasonable man or woman of its truth and purity and heavenly origin. Joseph replied, "Well, I will write the revelation, and we will see." Hiram then took the document to Emma to attempt a resolution to this problem. However, when he returned to Joseph and William, he stated, "I have never received a more severe talking to in my life." Emma is bitter and full of resentment and anger. Joseph quietly replied, "I told you you did not know Emma as well as I did." During the next few weeks, Joseph made several attempts to talk with Emma and convince her of the need for him to practice plural marriage. On one occasion, it appears that Joseph spent an entire day with her in an attempt to resolve this issue. There were recordings in some journals that this issue would bring Emma, or even both of them, to tears. Both Emma and Joseph were very private about this matter. Joseph never wrote his personal feelings about plural marriage. By the way, I would like to add that when I was reading these accounts on an issue that's so potentially volatile for a couple, there was never records of them screaming and yelling at each other. There was intense talkings, and it was usually behind doors, and the people who recorded it were the ones that worked in the home. And so I think both of them had the wisdom and discretion to have these conversations when they're out of the ear of the general public, and even within their own home, they did it as privately as possible. As regards Emma, the written accounts are limited. The most well-known and extensive account of a discussion about plural marriage was an interview Emma had with her two sons, Joseph III and Alexander, in the presence of her second husband, Louis Bittenden, in February of 1879. However, the interpretation of this interview is wrought with problems. Joseph III had investment in the outcome. He was at that time, president of the reorganized church. And this could not have been a pleasant conversation for Emma. The use of specific words became important to determine how Emma would respond. Remember, Emma was a woman of refinement and education. Social conversation and discretion were traits for which she was well known. Her love for Joseph was still present and quite deep, as was her love for her children. This could not have been an easy discussion. To her credit, Emma's deep feelings for Joseph did not diminish after his death. She is known to have kept the portrait in the mansion house long after his death. There was also a case of Joseph's brass razor and other items on her dresser throughout her marriage to Louis Bittenden. It is a tribute to Louis Bittenden that his respect for Emma included allowing her to keep these items. There are other accounts of Emma's behavior after Joseph's death that indicate that the experience with Joseph and plural marriage did not leave her bitter or with a cold heart. While she was married to Louis Bittenden, he did have an affair with another woman that resulted in a child. The woman, Nancy Abercrombie, named her child Charlie. However, she had great difficulty providing for his son. She asked Emma if Emma would care for him, and she did so without any resentment. In fact, Charlie later accounts that he was raised as one of Emma's own. Emma later employed Nancy in the home so that she could be close to Charlie. In Emma's biography, it is written, quote, "In an extraordinary act of compassion, she asked him to marry in order to provide Charlie with proper parentage after she died." They did so. That's Louis and Nancy, 1 year after Emma's death. By the end of 1843 and the beginning of 1844, the year of Joseph Smith, the issue of plural marriage as it affected Joseph and Emma appears to have run its course, or at least they were both preoccupied with the mounting opposition to the church. Joseph was very busy either teaching the leaders of the church their responsibilities, supervising the completion of the Nauvoo Temple, or in hiding from law enforcement, seeking to imprison him again. And after his death in June of 1844, Emma's main occupation was making sure that she could obtain monies and properties that were hers by law. And the events at this point appear to be divided according to personal loyalties. We do not have the time here to explore these events, but in the end, her decision was to remain in Nauvoo. If you were to ask the question of how one could resolve the issue of Emma's knowing that her husband was the prophet of the Restoration and her clash against plural marriage, you would be spot on. Later in 1860, Joseph Smith III relinquished a repeated request to be the prophet of the reorganized church. Again, this topic includes more information than we can possibly present here today, but Emma continued to deny that Joseph practiced polygamy. In regards to this conflict, I would provide a quote from a friend of her later years. Judge George Edmonds, who had been a friend to Emma as well as her legal counsel in later years, reflected on the paradox of Emma's position in an interview some years later. He stated, "I'll tell you, sir, no man could look Emma Smith in the face and tell a lie. She would detect it at once, and he knew it." When asked how he viewed what he had heard about polygamy and Emma's denial of it, the judge shifted in his chair, then with an odd smile replied, "That's just the hell of it. I can't account for it, nor reconcile her statements. Nevertheless, she was just the kind of woman I have said she was." My goal here today is not to resolve a conflict. Better researchers and writers have tried. They have expressed their doubts and inabilities to do so. It appears that we are left only with the character and the decisions of Emma and allowed to judge for ourselves. But in the context of a therapist, let me add a few words and observations around the issue of plural marriage and its effect on Emma and Joseph. To me, the issue is not whether she believed in plural marriage. The main question is, what impact did it have on their marriage? It would be somewhat foolish to think that the events we have reviewed had no impact on her decision to leave Malibu. When you counsel with people about marriage, the first issue that encountered invariably is an issue of trust. In my experience, it becomes the core of the discussion. In the relationship between Joseph and Emma, plural marriage cannot be discussed only as some dogma of revealed religion, ignoring the impact on the relationship itself. The discussion of trust can be very complex and is not limited to the trust extended to each other, but also considers the nature and ability of each person to trust others in general. If even one of the individuals in a marriage has grown up with violations of trust, you can be sure that will play a role to some degree after they become married. Interestingly enough, what is even more intriguing is that the issue of trust is often buried under other problems, such as finances, workplace behaviors, etc. Sometimes I find myself uncovering a lot of material in marriage counseling to get at the issue of trust, and problems coexist when the final solution is constructed. Joseph and Emma could not avoid the same struggle just because of their eminent position in the church. If you were simply listening to Emma describe these events as a therapist, I think that you could at least understand her own sense of anger and betrayal. The fact that she had to struggle with these feelings is not easily mitigated by the belief in the gospel principle. Here today in this setting, our goal is to understand, not judge or impose our own thoughts or feelings upon Emma. You have to at least admit that there is a basis for her remaining in Nauvoo if you can understand the high level of frustration and anger she voiced at Joseph for practicing plural marriage. One of the basic principles of a good marriage is not that you agree on everything, but that you come to agreement on how to handle those differences. And yet, despite these conversations, or at least for part of the time, Joseph would continue to marry a woman despite Emma's voiced disapproval. And though this appears to have ended sometime at the end of 1843, the damage had been done. That is to say that the marriages of Joseph to other women, some of whom Emma did not know, were not annulled or reversed, which leaves us with at least an appreciation of why Emma remained in Nauvoo. Would she be able to marry another man who also practiced plural marriage? What assurances did she have of her children who would be provided for? There are no easy answers to these questions, and we do not find any answers in the journals or records that are available to us. As I bring this discussion to a conclusion, I must acknowledge that there are many other details about Emma's life and marriage to Joseph that I have not mentioned here. Time would not permit it. However, I hope that I have successfully presented a type of capsule of her experience that accurately reflects both her character and the issues with which she had to struggle. Our goal here today was to make the effort to understand why Emma may have decided to remain in Nauvoo when the saints traveled west. Many of the documents and books try to address the same question, and they do not seem to have any definitive answers. My purpose today was to increase our understanding of what Emma had experienced and endured, and I hope that you have some better understanding of why she might have considered remaining in Illinois, and that this decision was not without justification, and perhaps not a bad one. It is my personal experience that the more we understand individual people and the human race in general, the more forgiving and understanding we are about the behaviors of others. To this end, it is my hope and wish that any decision made by Emma can be understood to be the result of deliberate and altruistic thoughts on her part, not a desire to endorse or promulgate self-interest. We need only look at her role as a mother to understand that she was only trying to provide for her children and grandchildren. We can all easily see that during the violent and uncertain nature of those days, she could not rely completely on neighborhood or community to provide for her children. On one occasion, she responded to inquiries about the Mormon religion by stating, quote, "I have always avoided talking to my children about having anything to do in the church, for I have suffered so much. I have dreaded to have them take any part in it." This gives us an idea of her thoughts as a mother. May these thoughts and comments I share today also increase your understanding. I feel very deeply honored for this opportunity, and certainly increase my understanding. So right now, I think I'll end and ask if there's any questions that people want to ask.
By the way, if they don't want to come up to the mic, just
repeat
the question.
No, that's fine.
I don't know if this is just gossip or if there's something to it, but I understand that Brigham Young approached Emma about becoming his, him taking over Joseph's role as her husband. And did that play a role in her choosing not to go to Salt Lake?
That's an excellent question. Very relevant. One of the things that I didn't include. So I'm glad you asked that because, the question was, oh, you.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
Most people know, I mean, the main title for, usually for Brigham Young is Lion of the Lord, and that is not an accident. If you can imagine having Emma and Brigham Young in a room with their strong personalities, you can imagine what went on. There has been some noted conflict between the two of them. I think mostly, there's probably several reasons. As a therapist, actually there was just an editorial in the Deseret News recently about the society that tracks Emma and Joseph. And they noted that both of them died repeating Joseph's name. As a therapist, you could go many places with that, but clearly the love for Joseph was shared by both of them. It was about a month after Brigham came to Nauvoo before he actually approached Emma. Some people argue that he had so much to do to organize the church, and there's truth to that. But one of Leonard Arrington's colleagues argued that the reason that Brigham Young delayed is he knew what he was going to be up against when he went in there. There was no mention specifically of Brigham Young asking or anybody inferring that Emma and become Brigham's wife. However, I think a reasonable person would conclude that given the other personalities there, Brigham probably would not have been the best pick. I mean that in sincerity and in good faith. I think that she would have been better matched, if I can go so far to say that, with other personalities that were there. And there were several men with whom she had good friendships, trusted friendships. And they're one of the main reasons we knew so much about the Bible. We knew the Bible translation we worked on prior to the RDS releasing. It was because she allowed Dr. John Bernhuizen to review it because she was good friends with him. So there was a lot that had to do with relationships with men that controlled where she was.
I am.
So you talk about how Emma's high-spirited, she's physically courageous and so on. I wondered if you had explored her leadership in the Relief Society and the opposition. She mobilized, 1,000 women to oppose this in the spring of 1844. So her public resistance in this fight is very interesting.
That's an excellent question. And actually, you guys are asking great questions. That's one of the things I had to exclude because of time. But the fact that you ask it shows that you want to know, so I can talk about that. The whole formation of the Relief Society has an interesting history. And by the way, there are detailed notes kept of all the meetings that they had in Nauvoo, and they're very, very interesting notes. They're good notes, both from a social point of view and a theological point of view, because Joseph and other leaders spoke there. But it also gave you a good feel of the likes of Emma Smith, Eliza Snow, and the other women that were there. To answer your question directly, in 1842 is when they founded the Relief Society. And the first discussion was what to call it. And the first council, whose name escapes me this minute, came up with a name and wanted to call it the Relief Society. And John Taylor said, John Taylor was president, said, let's call it the Benevolent Society. And so the women said, well, that's a good idea, we'll do that. But Emma respectfully stood up and said, I'd rather not call it that. And the reason she gave was because in those days, there was an international organization called the Benevolent Society. It was well known for corruption. And she said she did not want to be associated with that. And after that articulated explanation, they changed it to the Relief Society. In the Relief Society, at that time in Nauvoo, there was talk of infidelity and adultery. Now, we got a whole discussion about the words used, adultery, plural marriage, polygamy, bigamy, all those words. And if you read the journals carefully, especially William Clayton, who was a faithful journalist to Justice Smith, he uses these words carefully. And when those comments went around, the discussion did occur in the early Relief Society meetings to talk about integrity, female integrity. And the implication was fidelity in marriage. What Emma did not know is that some of the women in the room had been involved with Joseph in arranging plural marriages, and that some of the people in her counselor, that she had two counselors and and her secretary, Eliza Snow, were actually married to Joseph. It would be difficult to me under any circumstances to understand it's not difficult for me to imagine, it would be difficult for me to watch a woman come to a realization that the people she was working with were married to her husband without her knowledge. And what I want to add here, the thing that really struck me is there's a difference. There is a big difference between understanding a religious principle, no matter what your faith is, and then being told to practice and do it. That's a conflict with many of the women who, before they married Joseph, had to work out on their own. Emma admitted in her own words that she was, quote, jealous-hearted. I don't know exactly what that means, and I'm guessing it might have meant a little bit different to her than it does to us. But she acknowledges that struggle, and it was evident many times.
Yeah, before I heard this talk, in my own mind, I was thinking maybe she didn't want to go with Brigham Young and them, because up to that point, she had been the most important woman in the church, and she lost her position when Joseph died. But from listening to the talk, I was thinking maybe she partly didn't want to go with them because she was so upset about polygamy, and when they all left, it's kind of like she got rid of it, and she could just stay where she was, and it wasn't on her mind anymore. So.
I think all those observations you made are accurate. I mean, it does appear from a distance that she would have been disappointed at losing this eminent position. But that's why I went and gave you a clear description of her character, to give you some concrete evidence that she wasn't that shallow of a person. Remember, I think it's easy for us to underestimate the challenge of going from Illinois to Salt Lake, when we can do it now in less than a day and a half, depending on how fast you drive. I think that you're right. I think that you could make an argument that by staying in Nauvoo and having the majority of the saints move west, that she was away from this thing that plagued her life for those last 3 years. A lot of heated discussions. I might also add that there are many discussions about things that she did. People argue that she said or did to people that sound very mean-hearted. They're all secondhand accounts, and some of them, even among secondhand accounts, have conflicts. And I'll be specific, she was supposed to have pushed or hurt Eliza Snow when she found out she was married to Joseph. In the Book of Mormon Enigma, they make clear that those counts aren't particularly reliable. And I might add, they're not really consistent with the kind of person Emma was. I mean, she was high-spirited, and I'm sure she was angry. But if that were true, I think she would have done other things besides shoving Eliza Snow down the tires. I want to answer as many questions as I can.
Well, it just seems to me as a woman, if my trust had been broken in my marriage, and you know you implicated that, that's true. It comes out in all our relationship then in that marriage. How did she trust Joseph's religiously then and his revelations in other areas How do you put
that
together?
That's a great question, because trust is fundamental. It's fundamental to a lot of things that we don't even think about, on our friends, our kids. I think to answer that question directly, well, let me take two things. One, people's ability to trust really is a personal thing. There are people who have infidelity in their marriage and they stay married. And there's other people who have one incident of infidelity and they divorce. I don't understand that. I try to respect the individuals and they talk about this. But one of the indirect ways to answer your question is that she never denied the Book of Mormon. She's one of the few people who, she never saw the gold plates and handled them inside a cloth while she was cleaning and never doubted it. Well, there were other people who complained a lot about it, that they did, well, you know, I've done all this work, I've never seen them, but she didn't. And she practiced so many other things. Her compassion towards children and people in general. One of the things I didn't tell you is that her home was, although she held it as a hotel, there were many times as the saints were coming and going that people informally came and stayed. And her and Lucy Maxmith would sleep on the floor with a blanket while everybody else kept all the beds. Mind you, in Nauvoo, that's no small task. They had a lot of rooms in their house. So I think the only way to answer that is that there's just a part of her that we don't really know unless we could ask her, and that she, there were parts of what she truly believed in, but plural marriage was the most difficult part for her. Go ahead, John.
I just wanted to comment on that that famous folk story about the pushing Eliza Snow down the steps. I was in Nauvoo just a month or two ago with a bunch of other scholars who were kind of like reviewing those accounts, and we went around the houses and things like that. And one of the points that, as this thing is retold, it's such a strange story where, you know, supposedly there's this public kiss that Joseph does, which seems so totally out of character with anything that he was doing with them on the one hand. But on the other hand, when people are, it would have, Eliza's living in the homestead period of the house, and that is a tiny little narrow staircase. And they're clearly kind of conflating this idea of making up this story when it's in the mansion, when you could actually have a staircase like that. So that folk story, as famous as it is, doesn't seem like it can hold up.
First, let me say that I think you've done a wonderful job with this paper. It's just, I really enjoyed it. There is a dispute about when when Joseph and Emma moved into the mansion house, and I don't have the dates right in my head anymore. But according to Joseph III, they moved into the mansion house before Eliza moved in there, and the front part of the mansion house was completed first, and Joseph moves his office from the Red Brick Store to the mansion house. Or moves his office is what it says. And Joseph III marks that as the date they moved into the mansion house. The mansion house, the sign being hung and everything else, was when the addition of all those rooms on the back, which no longer exist, were there. And so it may have been in the mansion house. It may have been in the homestead. I think it was in the mansion house. But and I was talking with Locke McKay, who was over the Community of Christ properties just a couple of months ago, and we talked about that, and he agreed that it could well have been in the mansion house. That being said, I think there was a physical confrontation of some kind. There are enough stories about it, you know, whether she pulled her down with the hair of the head, or merely turned around in her nightclothes, or actually pushed her, you know, who knows. Eliza had been Emma's closest friend for a long time. She'd lived with them in Kirtland. She taught their children in school. She was living in Emma's home at Emma's invitation. And then for Emma to find out that she had a relationship and was married to Joseph, I would have pushed her down the stairs.
That was Linda. I thank you for saying that. That's really true, because it's and I appreciate you making those comments.
What I guess I would say is that I was probably talking to Locke right before he talked to you, because we had walked around and done all those things just a couple months ago, and he must have called you and talked about it. And then, I wanted to also, you know, on this question of the whether Emma would have had to marry someone to be able to, you'd have to marry someone in order to make this pioneer trek and make a home and everything like that. But all of the plural wives, it seems like, I think, either married Brigham Young or Heber C. Kimball. And I think it might have been very complicated, even if Emma was going to adopt this principle, to marry anybody other than those two guys, because from this eminent position you're talking about that she had held, if any other their positions were hardly secure, and if any other person was to you know, have married the main wife, the legal wife of the prophet, that would have been very complicated for them. That person would have been very elevated, you know, in their power, and threatened a threat also to Brigham Young. And then the other comment, one more thing, if I can, this idea that when people talk about how you reconcile Emma's continual denial of polygamy, or that it had happened. Joseph also knew that it was happening, and all through his life, consistently, he denied it in public that this was happening. And so Emma's policy actually continues Joseph's policy of public denial, and in fact, it's the people in Utah who break that policy of public denial and start admitting it, you know.
All the comments that are being made, I think, are giving you a good picture of just how complex this really is. To comment on Linda's remark, you can see that the portrayal of a friend, a close friend, just for... I just can't imagine being in a position where my spouse does things without letting me know, and then does it with my best... in this case, marriage, with my best friend. The instantaneous outrage of anger and courage is very typical. And then your remark about plural marriage, I just would say one quick thing. The words they used was very important to the person you were talking about.
Yep.
So you could say, for instance, Joseph Smith was accused of adultery. He actually took people to courts, both legal and church, and had them deny it, because he didn't commit adultery. He had married the woman that they were accusing him of being with. Now, those does may seem like trite words, but in those days, they were not. And actually, the first incident really outraged Oliver Cowdery, who is no small man in church history. He did many great things. Some other questions? Let's see, Chris, can I ever ask to... Can you hear when she does? Is that on? Yeah, it's on. It's on.
It's on.
Okay.
Get a little closer.
I from what I've read, I've heard it was rumored that Emma tried to poison Joseph Smith, and that Brigham Young had said that. What are your thoughts on that?
There are quotes that Brigham Young did accuse him of poisoning. Let me just put a footnote here. I don't know, it was years ago, when exactly, I can't forget what you did. Dialogue had an article about folklore in Mormon culture and Mormon. We are not, I repeat, we are not either innocent or avoid that. There's a lot of folklore that goes on. There are quotes of that. I don't have all the details. They dissipated. It's really difficult to pin that down, because he had been poisoned by other people. When he was dragged out of the house in Kirtland and Tarpon Feather, they tried to poison him. Another occasion, he was poisoned and she wasn't with him. What you're referring to is one night when they were eating and Emma had cooked the food. He went out and vomited. But, you know, it's so difficult to really pinpoint what that was. They didn't have refrigeration. They had to cure their meat. It'd be extremely difficult to know. Plus, some of the things that Joseph Smith endured physically left him with some conditions later on. Not severe and chronic ones as we know them, but it's impossible to rule out the effects over the years of that stuff. Are we out of time?
Yeah, but if there's one last question, a comment.
Or let's go. Having to do with the poisoning, there were no known poisons at the time that had the kind of reaction that Joseph did to that. And these stories came out later. It was interesting when we were doing our research. There was the archivist, Jeff Johnson, was the church archivist then, and he came to me one day and he said, "You know, there's a folder up here that it has never been cataloged. Would you like to see it? All the nasty things you never want to know about Emma Smith." And I think a lot of these stories came out. Joseph may have accused her of that, and she cried when he did, but that doesn't mean that she did it. And I don't know why she would do it. I mean, she could certainly be angry with him and so forth. I would have poisoned all those women instead. but there was a concerted effort when Emma's boys, her sons, came to Utah on missions and defended their father against polygamy and so forth, that these stories, people started coming out of the woodwork with these stories. And sometimes there would be five or six people saying the same story, and you could trace it back to one person. It wasn't like there were five or six witnesses to see it. And the poison is the same thing. I just don't put any stock into that out.
It would be hard, given that, and the purpose of giving all this information, so you could see what a minor part these kind of stories, like the poisoning and the pushing girl. I'd also just want to commend or thank the Community of Christ, which was formerly the Reorganized Church. Their allow of access to the records has gone a long way in allowing us to paint pictures out of many people, not just Emma. And so I appreciate that very much. But I thank you for your listening here and your time.